Well, hello, and welcome to Endeavors. Winter has officially hit Toronto here. It's about -4, -5 out right now, so we're all holed up in our houses, trying to stay warm. And not pay attention to everything that's happening in the industry right now with Harvey and Louie and Jeremy and James and all that. But I'm not here to talk about that. A little bit of a shorter show today, but we have two guests. You're going to hear from Angela Moon-Barquette, who is based out of Halifax, and she is a writer and professor and former associate director on television. And she worked on the show that you might have heard of called This Hour Has 22 Minutes. She's so familiar with that hour that she just recently wrote the book on it. An unauthor 25 years of 22 minutes, an unauthorized oral history of This Hour Has 22 Minutes, as told by cast members, staff, and guests. And people that are featured in the book are Henry Sawyer Foyner, who is the original director, Peter Mansbridge shows up, Gerald Lunds, one of the producers, and of course, Rick Mercer. And it's hard to believe that 22 Minutes has been on the air now for what's going into its 20th season. I mean, it started in the early 90s when there was no social media, there was barely internet. In fact, I don't think 22 Minutes built a website until 99-2000. It predates The Daily Show, it predates all of the satirical comedy shows that you see in the U.S., and it's obviously become somewhat of a Canadian institution. And the woman who wrote it is Angela Moon-Barquette, and she's a writer, magazine editor, and part-time instructor at the University of King's College in Halifax. And her work has appeared in The Walrus, The Chronicle Herald, Halifax Magazine, Saltscapes, and many other publications. And as mentioned, she did work as an associate director on the set of This Hour Has 22 Minutes. I spoke with her a few days ago about putting this book together. Here is my conversation with Angela Moon-Barquette. Angela Moon-Barquette, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Dan, thanks for having me.
So you are the author of 25 Years of 22 Minutes, the unauthorized oral history. I know you've had a long association with the show. How did you first become involved with the television program?
Well, actually, so I had worked at CBC Television here in Halifax for about 15 years. And I did a whole bunch of different jobs in my time there, but one of the jobs that I had there was as a floor director and sometimes as a script assistant. And I used to, when it came to 22 minutes, I would fill in for the person who was the regular floor director. So I didn't work on the show all the time, but over, you know, 6 or 7 seasons, I probably worked on 5 or 6 episodes a season, so I really got to know, you know, all the people that worked on the show and how the show operated.
Of course, this book has unauthorized history in the title, but I understand initially that the production company was on board with this and then they backed out. What exactly happened there?
Well, what happened was when I conceived of the idea for this book, and after the publisher had decided that they wanted to go ahead with it, the very first thing I did was approach Michael Donovan, and he had been the person who had started Salter Street Films, and that was the production company that originally owned This Hour Has 22 Minutes. And so I went to Michael Donovan right away and said, you know, this is what I want to do. And I'd love to have your support. And he initially, you know, his response was, yeah, I think this, you know, we should move forward with this. But, you know, he works now. His company is a huge corporation, DHX Media. And of course, the lawyers got involved and there were some negotiations. And so they just eventually decided that they would not cooperate with the making of the book.
But you were able to get a lot of the people who worked on the show, both behind the scenes and in front of the scenes. The process for you of getting all these different people to talk about their experience, what was that like?
Oh, it was amazing, and it was so much fun. You know, there were so many. I had so many hours of interviews with people that were, you know, great storytellers and that had wonderful stories to tell. So, you know, from that point of view, the process was really, really fun. And yeah, all the voices that are represented in the book do a great job of sort of, you know, telling us kind of the history of the show and what's happening now on the show, and telling some great stories that have happened over the years as well.
I mean, when you have that many people talking about the same thing, there's going to be conflicting or contrasting memories a little bit. From a creative and editorial perspective, how do you sort of, do you just put everything in, or how do you decide this is what's going to fit in best with this section of the book?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I approached it as an oral history. And, you know, what that means is that all the people that worked on the show, the cast members, the directors, the writers, the producers, everybody gets to tell their story in their own words. And then what I do is weave those words together into what, you know, reads like a conversation, as if they were all talking in the same room at the same time. And I did that because, you know, when so many people have an experience of the same situation, they always have different points of view about that situation. And using, you know, telling the story through an oral history gives everybody a chance to tell their story in their own words. And you know, it means that I don't, you know, as a narrator, come at the story saying, you know, this is the one true thing that went down. Everybody gets to say, this is what happened, here's how I saw it. So I think it works, you know, very well when you have a lot of really strong personalities that have a story to tell.
You know, initially the show was only, had a budget for 20 episodes, but they could pull out after 8. And here we are 25 years later, and it's become a Canadian institution. What do you think has contributed to the show's long-term success?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things. You know, one thing is that the show itself has proven to be flexible and versatile enough to be able to withstand change. You know, so the first big test of that kind of thing was when Rick Mercer left the show. There was a big question of, you know, whether the show would actually survive that, and you know, it turned out that the show did survive that, and you know, since then, you know, cast members have come and gone, writers have come and gone, producers have come and gone, and the show is built on a very solid kind of structural foundation, so that when, you know, a piece comes, a piece changes, the whole thing doesn't collapse. So it has that kind of very flexible foundation that's helped it survive in terms of the production itself. But, you know, in terms of the show, I think it's, you know, Canadians have always had an appetite for news, and I think that this show has shown Canadians who they are. You know, it kind of reflects Canada back to itself. And it does that by, you know, looking at the sort of the centers of power from the fringes, and I think a lot of Canadians relate to that very much.
That's an interesting point about Canadians have an appetite for news, because the one cast member who is still, the one original cast member who is still a part of the show was the one who sort of had the least interest in the news, and that was
Kathy Jones. Did you get a sense from people of why Kathy has chosen to stay on all these years, whereas the others have come and gone?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for her, but I know that, you know, just from being an observer, I know that Kathy is, you know, one of the most brilliant character performers in Canada. She's just, you know, she's just an amazing talent. And I think, you know, whether she was interested in news or not, she really, her talent just rises above. And also she, you know, she does tap into the zeitgeist, whether it's like, whether it's newsy or not. You know, when you look at her angry yoga character that's quite popular, you know, that's popular because it speaks to a lot of Canadians. And, you know, news or not, I think that's part of the secret of her longevity.
How do you think, you know, because this show premiered in the early 90s before, you know, before the internet was everywhere, how do you think that culture has affected the show, the impact of social media and the widespread use of the internet?
Oh, well, gee, there were stories. You know, there's a story in the book about Rick and Stockwell Day, which is actually kind of a pioneering internet story. You know, 22 Minutes didn't even have a website. This was in 2000, and Stockwell Day was running for the Alliance Party in Canada, and Stockwell Day had this idea that if 3% of the population was in favor of some issue, he would hold a referendum on that if he was elected. And Rick Mercer saw that as kind of a backdoor way of getting things like abortion and gay marriage onto a ballot, you know. And so Rick decided to test that by trying to get 3% of the population to say that they wanted Stockwell Day to change his name to Doris Day. And so he had to actually go to Salter Street Films and say, we need to make a website. They didn't have a website at that time. They had to go get a server in India to do it. And they built 22minutes.com, and he ran this poll, and he got millions of Canadians all voting to say Stockwell Day should change his name to Doris Day. And, you know, and it was an incredible testament to, you know, the power of A, a good idea, and B, the power of the internet. And Stockwell Day became something of a laughingstock and sort of backed down. And it really affected his, you know, political future at that time.
There was I forget who specifically it was, but there was an anecdote from someone in here that said one of the reasons the show worked was because the original cast was four Newfoundlanders, and they have a very unique look at Canadian culture. How much of the show's success do you think is attributed to that fact?
Yeah, that was Phyllis Platt. She was a CBC executive. She thought it was really, really important that they, as you know, Newfoundlanders, were always bringing that outsider perspective to the show. I think it's important. There, you know, there are varying opinions on how important that is, and you know, different show producers have had different opinions on that over the years. And there have been cast members that were, you know, not Newfoundlanders, like Jerry Hall and Colin Mochrie, and you know, some would say that had an effect on the show, and some wouldn't. So I think, you know, I think the Newfoundland sensibility, which is at the root of the show, is important in that, you know, again, it's that sort of looking as an outsider onto the centers of power. But, you know, I think the show has evolved enough over the years that it's not as central to the show's identity now as it once was.
And, of course, this show got its start before we saw a lot of this kind of satire in the States, like created The Daily Show and Last Week Tonight. How do you think it has lasted all this year, especially now in the era of fake news?
Yeah, well, you know, I think you know, satirical news is as important as ever. You know, I one of the things I say is I think good satire does the same thing that good journalism does, you know, and that is, you know, it speaks, it talks to the centers of power, it hoists the power by their own petard, you know, it's a way of criticizing power structures and politics you know, just as much as journalism is, you know, it's a way of holding them to account. And so I think that in doing that, I think, you know, satirical news is in many ways as important as real news.
Do you think that, you know, because in a lot of ways we are very saturated with both media and fake news, does 22 minutes carry the same weight and have the same influence that it did, you know, 10, 15 years ago?
I guess I can't really answer that. You know, based on what I know about the show, I don't have a good answer to that. I think, you know, I think Canadians are still watching the show. I think as many Canadians are watching it now as have watched it in the past, and that's probably the only measure of that, you know.
Where do you think the show fits into the pantheon of Canadian culture, and then what do you think it means to this country?
Oh, well, you know, I think it helped us. You know, I remember when Canadians didn't know who they were and what made Canadians different from Americans, and I think that this show helped show them, you know, what it means to be Canadian and why it matters and how it's important. You know, when Rick Mercer did Talking to Americans, you know, it was that old trope that we all knew, you know, that the Americans don't know anything about Canada and they come to Canada in July with their skis on their cars or whatever. But, you know, it was a true trope and one that was kind of validating for Canadians. So, yeah, I think it's been important to us in that way.
And of course, Rick Mercer just announced that he's going to be ending his show after, I think, 15 seasons. What do you think, and, you know, he's sort of our version of Jon Stewart, what do you think he's meant to the Canadian comedy world?
Well, I mean, Rick is such an insightful, you know, Rick is much more than a comedian. He is a very insightful and political person. He has been from day one. And I think that his perspective has always been, he's been able to give Canadians perspective on events that maybe they couldn't figure out, you know, what those things meant to them. So I think, you know, he's razor sharp. He's so smart. And I think, you know, he has done a lot to help Canadians understand issues, you know, on 22 Minutes and on his own show.
Well, the book is 25 Years of 22 Minutes, as told by cast members, staff, and guests, an unauthorized oral history of this hour is 22 Minutes. Angela Mumbarquette, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Dan.
Alrighty.
That was Angela Mumbarquette. She was a former associate director of This Hour is 22 Minutes, and she's a freelance writer and editor and journalism professor. Once again, her book is 25 Years of 22 Minutes, an unauthorized oral history of This Hour has 22 Minutes, as told by cast members, staff, and guests. Something a little bit different now. A couple days ago, I was invited to attend a screening of a brilliant film called Empire of Dirt. Now, the unusual thing about this screening is that Empire of Dirt has already been out officially for 4 years and has been sort of making the rounds on screenings for the last two. So it's not necessarily a new film, but given its subject matter, it's about three generations of Indigenous women within the same family that are coming to terms with their demons, essentially. And I think it's somehow more important now in terms of the conversation and discourse we're having than it was then. And the film has a fantastic cast. Kara G and Che Eyre and Jennifer Podemsky are the three women, and Podemsky also is a producer on the film. And it also features other great Canadian actors such as Michael Cram and the great Luke Kirby, and Tony Napo. They all appear in the film as well, and Raoul Benaja as well. So I was at the screening on Wednesday, and there was a Q&A afterwards with Kara G, Jennifer Podemsky, and co-producer Jeff Ewart. So we had a chance to record the entire Q&A. I apologize, the sound isn't great in parts. But it's definitely an important discussion, so we're just gonna play the entire thing. So this is a Q&A with Kara G, Jennifer Podemsky, and Jeff Ewart from the film Empire of Dirt.
For me, my own life is completely different from her life, and in fact, one of the reasons I wanted to do this film. What spoke to me about it is that my mom is actually, like, my best friend in the whole world. We're very, very, very close. And I can't imagine how hard it would be to know how to be a good mom when you haven't had that experience. And so when I think about the legacy of the residential school system and the scoop and all of the different ways that we've tried to, you know, kill Native people in this country. It's that's a really important part of that is how to be a family. And I think that that's a question that everyone can relate to, no matter what background you come from. Is how do you learn how to be a good mom? How do you learn how to bond through the generations? And that's something that our people have had attacked.
I think it too was important that the characters, like the legacy of residential school is, you know, it's really a legacy of colonization, right? So there are very deeply embedded narratives within Canadian society that come from legislation and policy that were designed to completely annihilate all Native people. So the fact that we're even here to tell our stories and to exist is a miracle. So I think that's why it's, you know, important as a storyteller to tell stories that are, you know, echoes of that experience. But in this specific story, I found it fascinating that we had an opportunity to look at a family who hasn't even, you know, reconnected to their pain. They haven't reconnected to their trauma or the source of their trauma. They haven't really connected to their culture. They haven't really connected to their language and their identity. You know, it's sort of there in pieces, but it's not, it's very messy. And I think that was an important place to be, like, the pieces that came together to bring these women back together is like the beginning of the story, mm-hmm. You know, sort of. So, and then to be able to have them, to just try to make a movie with all women and then have them also be Native and mm-hmm. see what people talked about was very, I think it was an interesting social experiment. Because a lot of people, like, I thought I was very brave to not wear any makeup.
Yeah.
After being an actor for, like, you know, my whole life and always being in the chair and doing, and you too. I mean, we really didn't have we had a makeup artist, but we really didn't have those frills. And I thought it was so empowering as a woman to, like, just be fully natural and in my zone. And no one ever mentioned that. So I was like, oh. Okay, well, I guess that's not a big thing. but, you know, so in that regard, as a performer, that was really empowering for me to, like, own that space and be totally natural. Anybody has that question?
So I just, for the record, I noticed the makeup issue and I thought it was I don't want to say courageous because it just made so much sense in what in the whole movie. Like it just like made so much sense. It was great, but I know the bigger context.
Yeah, like you're just always so, you know, everyone's so made up.
Yeah.
You know, and this is really, we wanted it to be raw. And it worked, it added to it, and we did really afford to spend time.
Yeah.
Mostly.
Yeah, Julia did all of the hair and
yeah.
all of the makeup. Yeah.
But you're right, it's distracting sometimes too when you're watching a story and someone's obviously perfectly coiffed. Yeah, it takes you out of it.
And you know, a lot of movies that I do in my life, people are always trying to make me look more native. And whether it's like a wig or browner skin, or you know, they're always trying to do something.
Middle part.
You know, middle part.
Middle
like
part always.
It's really kind of racist. And you know, I'm not gonna prove to anyone who I am or where I come from, you know, in my own movie. So.
So there's a big connection for First Nations with spirituality. And I was wondering, how do people reconcile forgiveness versus forgetting things? How do they reconcile the fact of trying to forgive what happened in the past and moving ahead without forgetting what happened?
It's a good question. I think that that's an individual experience. You know, I feel very privileged to be a filmmaker who goes around and speaks to a lot of people about that. And I think it's different for everybody. Some people are able to share their experience to create understanding and build bridges. Some people are not able to talk about it at all. And some people are in, you know, a lot of pain.
Is it early?
And
is it still too early to talk about that at the moment?
Early is a weird word because it's like we're still in it, right? We're still so in it. Like the Indian Act, it exists. It's a thing, right? And if you were just to read that, I don't know if anyone's read it, but it's like really, really bad. And this is like what we live under, right? This is the policy that we live under. And it's, so we're like in it still. It's a lot different today for me than it was for my mom. You know, a lot different, and I hope that it will be different for my kids, you know, that they will thrive. What do you think?
Yeah, I can't help but think of being in Berlin. I've never been to Berlin, but they wear their history very openly in the city, and there's reconciliation is discussed openly, and there's monuments and plaques, and the history is very evident, and we don't have that here because it's not over. There was that non-apology apology for residential school, which, like, don't think counts. I don't think that counted as the end of anything, really, in my opinion. But, yeah, I think for that sort of conversation to be had, it's hard to forgive someone for punching you in the face while they're still punching you in the face, right? So, yeah.
But I do think a lot of good things are coming of the, you know, reconciliation conversation. I just think that it's dangerous for people to think that that's the last chapter. Really the beginning chapter of the story.
And talking about that reconciliation, how are First Nations responding to this gesture that is being made right now that is at the very beginning?
I can't really speak for everybody. Everyone's different. You know, we have communities that are on reserve, that are unceded, that have never been, you know, don't have any agreements with government that are traditional territory. We have agreements that are you know, under the control of the federal government. We have urban communities, we have communities that are, you know, across the country, very different culturally, very diverse, you know, different experiences. So everybody has a different perspective on that. I think generally, if I was to say, like, you know, what do people think? I think that there's probably still quite a bit of anger and some healthy skepticism. And some healthy skepticism, yeah.
And today there are other issues affecting First Nations. There's lack of drinkable water. There's the problem of missing women. I don't know. I mean, I came to Canada because as an immigrant, because it was a land of opportunities. And then I read the papers and I realized people don't have drinking water. And I was taken aback, right? So is there anything we can do as an individual to help? Like, how can we help? Because that's not the life that I'm living in Canada. That was not the life I was living from home. And here, people are living it. So is there anything we can do?
I think that finding grassroots organizations like the Ottoman Collective and finding ways to support is, that's fabulous that that's happening here tonight. I think education, knowing, reading and knowing what's happening is definitely really helpful, just in a real day-to-day way.
Mm-hmm.
It's always nice to not have to break it to someone that things are bad here for Native people. So doing that research on your own is really...
Mm-hmm. There's some good publications, like Muskrat Magazine is a really good publication online, and that's like, you know, Indigenous perspective through an Indigenous lens.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, to say Indigenous is probably not a good direction to go in, because then you lose sight of the fact that there are so many different nations and so many different languages, you know. I get approached all the time to help people translate something in a language, and I'm like, that's Mohawk. that's Mandarin. I mean, I don't even speak my own language, so, and, you know, all of the different languages and all of the different diverse nations, I think that's something that people could help with by trying to identify, like, you know, when you meet someone and they are First Nations or Métis or Inuit, find out, you know? So, like, on my bio, when it says Anishinaabe, most people don't know what Anishinaabe means, but for me, it's, like, one little step closer.
Mm.
Someone might ask, what is Anishinaabe? What does that mean, you know? So, yeah, publications, ask questions. Well, it means the people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the people that are of the Algonquian linguistic group. And the language is called Anishinaabe. But I'm still learning that. But that's the, you know, that's the reality for many of us who are, you know, second generation survivors of residential school.
Mm-hmm.
Still trying to reconnect to language.
And I think this is very personal too, but what would be, according to you, indications of a way forward? Like, to live together in Canada?
Self-determination. Obliterate the Indian Act. Change the education system. Allow First Nations to control their own child welfare system. That's just a start, I think.
Mm.
Yeah, integrate culture into the education system.
Yeah, language revitalization. And just shifting the paradigm that, you know, I went to my son's grade one class today and the teacher asked what they know about First Nations, and most of the kids said nothing. The other few said they kill animals. The other one said they didn't get to buy clothes like we do. So, you know, shifting these kinds of paradigms, like, you know, how about just retelling the story?
Yes.
So that it's more accurate. Like, you know, the survival of settlers relied upon the help of all the people that were here. Like, we would not all be here if we didn't learn how to live here in this land, in this weather. Like, simple stuff.
And we're not all gone.
Yeah, and we're here.
We're not mythical.
And we're here.
Creatures.
So
right here.
Real life. You know, it's a lot of reform. A lot of reform. Like, you know, law and justice. Like, these are systems that our own democracy that we exist in came from the Six Nations, you know, the Iroquoian Confederacy. It came from, like, an original people's structure of government. Because it was here for thousands of years, and it worked. So, you know, just shifting some of those things. But in order to do that, you have to get rid of certain policies and legislations, because those in themselves create, you know, these realities that prevent us, our people, from, you know, truly thriving. But it's so complex. It's so complex.
Anybody has any questions? I have a comment, that's right.
Yes.
Really resonating with this story and with this discussion. And just want to say that we've all been impacted by this history. Whether our lineage is First Nations or not. And I come from a Jewish family. And my grandmother married a man who was likely a residential school survivor after she had a previous marriage. And there was one child who I did meet. This is an aunt that I met. And she is one of the missing women. And so my background, my blood lineage is Ashkenazi, Jewish. But I'm just starting to put two and two together realize that we're dealing with some of the very similar impacts of intergenerational trauma, and I'm not talking about it. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm speaking of it now. And I'm sure there's many other families who are impacted that way. And my parents' generation didn't talk about these things, whether it was this kind of trauma or the Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust. So many things in that generation were not out in the open, and they're just starting to be. And this is really wonderful. And thank you for helping.
Thank you. Thank you for you. Don't have any more questions.
I just
say thank you.
Oh, I have a question.
Perfect.
Still wants to come. Well, how many years old is it?
4 years.
4 years old. So when you would have shown it, wherever, when it was played, there wouldn't have been a landline recognition initially. Times have changed in the last 4 years, and land claims recognition is now everywhere you go, every school. And, I mean, personally, you know, I just finished reading Lee Miracle, I'm getting a break, but I wasn't reading that 4 years ago.
Right.
And I'm just wondering how you're finding now the reception is different, the conversations are different, is it you pleased, is it aggravating that, you know, things weren't highlighted 4 years ago, and that was only 4 years ago. Should have been 14 years ago or 24 years ago. And I can work it, but we don't have that conversation. So I'm just wondering where, you know, wherever you were at, when you now look back 4 years ago, are there differences?
Like politically?
Well, no,
socially.
Not what's happening. Just how you, you know, the reception of the audience is now, reception of the audience then. And
I don't think so. The audience seems to. Usually usually this film engages an audience who likes independent film, who likes like sort of outside the like the mainstream kind of movies, who are open-minded, who, that kind of thing. We've also done a lot of like discussion. She's traveled to do workshops with, you know, communities that are so different than ours in the States. You probably have more experience.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if it's so much across time as it is in different regions.
Is there more heightened awareness now than there was 4 years ago?
Or not? It's hard to know because I think the people who are coming to see this film already have that
selecting
awareness. So I'm not sure. But definitely across different regions, and especially showing this film in the States, there's a different feeling. And they called it boarding school, which sounds so fancy. It's a musical move, but they have a very different. They're in a different place down there, that's for sure.
Although, you know, I have thought about that recently and thought, I wonder how different it would be if this came out today.
Mm-hmm.
If it would engage a more like mainstream audience
because of everything.
Because of like a little bit more awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So I see where you're going with that.
Mm-hmm.
I do see a change in the film industry. Like I think today, if we were trying to make this movie, it would be a lot less hard. It felt like impossible at the time. Because a lack of awareness. Just so many different reasons. It feels like, I don't know, I feel like people wanted it to be more native. Like, non-native people wanted it to be more native.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up making it ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have any money. We had support from Mongrel, but we didn't have any money from anybody to make it. So that's sort of the road we had to take.
But when you
lives.
Say more
native,
what does it mean?
Are they government grants?
We got some. We got money from Telefilm, our distributor, tax credits. But yeah, going back to what Jim was saying earlier, okay, one woman, three women, three native women.
That's
like X. So
can you make the lead women maybe a star or a name? You know, not native.
Wasn't there a note somewhere about they wanted to see more dream?
More drumming, more singing.
Yeah.
Like, that's not what it's about. It's about something different.
But we initially tried to make this for $1 million, which is still nothing. And then we kept getting no, so the budgets kept dropping.
And then we had the money, but then gave it back.
Because we wanted to make it the way we wanted to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought, and I think that was $600,000. We said, you know what, no, we'll try on our own. And then that's what we did, and we premiered at TIFF, and we're nominated for 5 Canadian Screen Awards. So it was kind of like a some scenes, and I think, you know, we were shooting on a lake, it was really beautiful, and I should have really enjoyed it, but I remember being across the street in a garage on my laptop trying to close financing so we could pay the crew, and it was just, it was hard.
What lake was it?
Lakes and Cove.
We shot it in Keswick, mostly.
So, coming back to the conversation of, like, it would have been easier if we do it now, do you have something coming up, which take on the same
I quit feature films.
You did?
She has lots going on. You should watch her.
That's true.
Expanse, too.
Yeah, I'm on The Expanse. I have a couple films. Someone just came out last week called Carmilla. It's a cult classic.
It's
a cult classic, yeah. It's extremely popular with queer teenagers. It's based on a web series, and it's got millions of fans, and it's a really crazy thing to be a part of. And it's amazing. So The Expanse, we're in the middle of shooting the third season of that right now. That's probably the biggest thing. I did a film called Sundowners, just came out, it hit the light box. I've got another one coming out in the next year called Red Rover, which was actually directed by Shane Belcourt.
And that was her first movie 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And she was one of the your TIFF picks a handful of actors to be their rising stars, and she was one of the rising stars of TIFF.
Nice. And we just finished a series called Future History that should be coming out within the next 6 months. Hopefully in the spring. For sure on APTN, and hopefully on other networks.
Nice.
Yeah, there's always lots of projects. Just depends which one, you know, which one, I don't know, people like.
Yeah, which one are you going to put heart and soul into?
Yeah. This got made, like, it was the last shot. Like, I was breastfeeding at the time, and I thought, you know what, there's just no way I can do this. Like, there's just no way. I've already had one child through this. I've been doing this for years. Got the money, we gave it back, whatever, now we have no money, and I'm breastfeeding, tandem, and I'm about to make this movie, and I was producing another show, so it was like, I realized though at that moment, you know, since this is an entrepreneurial space, that entrepreneurial spirit of like, what's behind that brick wall? Oh wait, it's a metal wall. What's behind that metal wall? Ironclad gates behind another brick wall. Oh, interesting. And then, you know, you just keep going. And then suddenly it just opens up and, you know, you're suddenly in it.
Yeah, but I'm glad you made this miracle, and I'm really, really happy to have asked you to do this. And
thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you all for coming.
And that was a Q&A with Empire of Dirt stars Kara G and Jennifer Podemski and producer Jeff Ewart. And I believe Empire of Dirt is on Netflix if you would like to check out the film. And I highly recommend it. It is a great piece of Canadian cinema. That does it for me today. Thanks for tuning in. And we will see you next time. Bye for now.